And so if you find yourself in a crisis, doing the turtle move and trying to go within your shell is a losing strategy. It's going to be like a turtle who's crossing the highway and then sees an 18-wheeler bearing down, goes into its shell. What's going to happen? That's it. You're going to get crushed. You're going to get run over by the truck. So instead, it's incumbent upon you as an organization, when you're in a time of crisis, to do what feels most unnatural and most painful, which is to actually get in the fight, to defend your organization, to defend yourself, to engage.
Welcome to the CEO Coaching International podcast. What we do on this show is we find the world's leading entrepreneurs and CEOs, and we spend about a half hour with them and really dig into their story. We want to understand the strategies and the tips and the tools that they use to make big happen in their business. And by the end of each episode, you'll have actionable ideas that you can implement on your path to big success. To learn more about CEO Coaching International and how we can help you dramatically grow your business, visit us at CEOCoachingInternational.com. When it comes to a crisis for your company, it's not a question of if, it's a question of when. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the CEO Coaching International podcast. I'm your host, Steve Sandusky. My guest today is Evan Nierman. Evan is founder and CEO of Red Banyan, which is an international crisis management and public relations firm. He is also the author of the new book, The Cancel Culture Curse, From Rage to Redemption in a World Gone Mad. In today's show, we discuss what CEOs should know about crisis public relations, what you can do to prepare in advance so you are ready when a crisis hits, and we discuss the rise of cancel culture and how that may affect what you do as a leader. With that, please enjoy my conversation with Evan Nierman. Well, it seems like it's easier than ever to find yourself or your company in a media firestorm from something that you said or something that you did. So I'd love for you to start by setting the stage that crisis communication plays in your public relations strategy.
Well, it's a critical piece. And I think, you know, for years, I was running around pre-COVID and people thought that I was an alarmist and I was Chicken Little, the sky is falling, because I was having conversations with business owners in every industry and saying, crisis is inevitable, so you got to be prepared for it. And nine times out of 10, people would say, wow, you know, I hear you, but they weren't really buying it. And I think that the COVID-19 pandemic fundamentally changed businesses, obviously the economy, how we all work, but it also opened up the eyes of a vast majority of people who came to understand crisis is inevitable and our organization needs to be ready. We need to have a plan in place in advance before we need it, because it's not a maybe this could happen or possibly, it is going to happen. And I talk about all the time that the flip side of crisis is opportunity. It gave an opportunity for businesses to better understand where they might be vulnerable and to start really prioritizing crisis communications and crisis management, as opposed to it being something that's a nice to have. It's become something that's a must have.
I have a colleague and he is fond of saying it's better to prepare than to repair. And that's exactly what I hear you saying here. So when it comes to crisis communication, what can we do to prepare for it? Because we know it's going to happen. So what are some steps that we can actually go through to be prepared for it?
It's better to prepare than to repair. I think that's brilliant. And I agree with that completely. Here's a misperception that's out there. Crisis is just this ambiguous thing. Yeah, it's going to happen, but it's going to come like a bolt of lightning out of the blue. I'm not going to know where it's going to come from. So therefore, I can't really be prepared for it. And nothing could be further from the truth. Organizations can know with a relatively high degree of certainty where they're most likely to have a problem moving forward. A lot of times it has to do with the industry in which they operate, the history of the company, the personalities, et cetera. So if you're willing to do the hard work of taking a critical view of yourself and your business, you can actually game out well in advance what are the areas where you're most likely to face a threat. And it can be an uncomfortable exercise to go through, because no one wants to think about even the possibility that they could get into an issue that threatens their reputation, their revenue, even the viability of the organization. But responsible CEOs and smart leaders can actually go through that process. They could take a hard look at themselves, their industry, their individual company. The details will be different. Those will always be variations on a theme. So therefore, the specifics of what's going to happen, who it's going to be within the organization, or what an employee might say on social media that sparks outrage, or something that happens, an incident in the office itself, those details you may not be able to game out, but you'll be able to predict with a high degree of likelihood where the problems are most likely to emanate. Crisis management and a crisis communications plan is like insurance. You don't want to spend your money on it, but when you need it, you're damn sure glad you have it.
What would you say are some of the steps in a framework? So if you put this plan together, is there like, okay, here's like five parts of the plan, and we know that the individual situation is going to vary, but if we use this framework to address the situation, we're going to be able to control the situation here and not let it spiral out of control.
So I'm going to give you a couple of examples of what should be in your crisis plan, and then I'm going to tell you where you can go to actually get tons of details and create your own. A couple of the broad strokes things you need to be thinking about is, one, imagining where your vulnerabilities are likely to be. Two, figuring out in advance who is going to comprise your crisis management team. Now, in most cases, that means the founder or the CEO is in that group. In instances involving highly technical businesses where there's a lot of expertise or specifics around what you do, you may want to consider having a COO or a CTO. Your in-house general counsel or your outside general counsel is someone who you may want to have. And obviously, you need a communications person, whether that you end up opting for a chief marketing officer, or your director of communications, or if you're a smaller business and you don't have that, perhaps you even want to go and get an external resource to serve. So figuring out your crisis team is another key step. Next is, who's going to be the spokesperson? Who's going to be the face of the organization in a time of need where the stakes are high and you can't afford to make mistakes? So that is another critical element in determining. Also, things to think about: how are people going to be able to contact you if they are coming to you either from the general public or the media? Is there an easy way to filter all inbound communications to one central place so that it gets to the crisis team and to the spokesperson? Have you already target mapped who your key audiences are with whom you're going to need to communicate in a time of crisis? Many times people leap to the assumption that the single most important audience is either the media or this amorphous general public, to the detriment of neglecting some of the core audiences, such as employees, your partners, your joint venture partners, your suppliers, your vendors. So these are all elements that need to be within a really detailed and smart crisis communications plan. And I'm going to tell you the best way that you can go about creating your own plan is looking in a book called Crisis Averted, PR Strategies to Protect Your Reputation and Revenue. I'm telling you this not as a shameless plug for my first book, but because the reason I wrote that book was to help business owners and leaders protect themselves and avoid crisis in the first place. There's an entire chapter in that book about how to create your own crisis PR playbook. So if you check out that book and you go in there or you assign some of your team members to read it, I'm confident that you'll take the specific guidance that's in there and you can apply it to your own business starting immediately.
Now, this may vary depending on the crisis at hand, but what would you say is the ultimate objective of the crisis PR with any given crisis situation that comes up?
Well, the single most important thing that you want to do and not do in a crisis is you want to make smart and strategic moves without making things worse. And the single worst thing that you can do when you're in a crisis is to compound your crisis by reacting, by not having a plan or not having a capable or competent or cogent response to how you're going to address the situation. So being prepared is step one, and then being able to execute against that plan in a time of need is really vital. and something that each of us has to combat. Because in a time where you're under pressure, you're under fire, maybe your organization is being criticized, it's a very personal thing. It's very upsetting. You're seeing this business that through blood, sweat, and tears, you've built from nothing. You're providing jobs for people. You're providing opportunities for them to learn and grow. And all of a sudden, it all is either being criticized or even threatened. It can be a very disorienting process. I've heard clients of ours describe it as being in a washing machine where you're just tumbling over head over heels. It just feels like you can't catch your breath. You're being drowned and you're just tumbling over and over again. So it's a very tough thing to deal with on a personal and an emotional level. And one of the instincts that we have is either fight or flight. And many times it's flight. The organization makes the erroneous decision. In a time of crisis, what we need to do is just batten down the hatches. We need to stop talking. We need to do and say nothing. And they have that as their principal strategy. Let's just duck. Let's find cover, and let's wait for the storm to pass. That used to work when we were living in a different world. In a different era, you could wait for a media firestorm to pass you by because the number of people who were actually going to find out about it was relatively limited. It was based on your own geography. Who are the media outlets covering you in a certain area? And I'll just pick on Shreveport, Louisiana, because I grew up there. But if you're a business owner in Shreveport, Louisiana, and you have a problem, well, you can afford to wait. This is going back 10, 15 years. Not a big deal to just ignore the Shreveport Times, the newspaper, when they call for a comment, ignore the TV stations when they come, or just deal with it. And then know in a few days, it's all going to go past because the people in Shreveport are either going to see it or they're not. But then no one else is really going to find out about it. Well, that world is gone. Now, there is interconnectedness among every market. Every single person who has one of these in their pocket is connected to every other person on the planet who's connected. And so there's a 24/7 news cycle. There's rapid dissemination of information. And so if you find yourself in a crisis, doing the turtle move and trying to go within your shell is a losing strategy. It's going to be like a turtle who's crossing the highway and then sees an 18-wheeler bearing down, goes into its shell. What's going to happen? That's it. You're going to get crushed. You're going to get run over by the truck. So instead, it's incumbent upon you as an organization, when you're in a time of crisis, to do what feels most unnatural and most painful, which is to actually get in the fight, to defend your organization, to defend yourself, to engage. And there's a concept that I believe very strongly in called press the truth, which is this notion that you cannot simply afford to hope or pray that a crisis is going to pass you by. You've got to get into it. You have to defend yourself. You have to press the truth. You have to express yourself. You have to convey the facts in the situation, because if you're not willing to tell your story, no one else is going to tell it for you. And those who are going to tell your story aren't going to do it in the way that you wish it was told.
Now, you mentioned press the truth. Now, this is interesting because what is truth? And in recent years, there seems to be a bit of a disagreement on what is truth and what is not truth. But as it relates to the crisis PR situation, you also mentioned the fight or flight response. We've got some folks who, when they're in a crisis, they'll double down and they'll just like deny. And then you've got others who will immediately apologize. What are your thoughts on how do we discern when it's appropriate to deny, when it's appropriate to apologize and hope people will accept the apology and we can all move on and move forward? How do you think about that?
It's a great question. And there's so many parts to it. First of all, this notion that there's lots of truths, I would argue that's nonsense. That's not the case. And I actually am not a believer. I understand it's become very popular for people to say, oh, I need to speak my truth. I actually take issue with that because at the end of the day, truth is truth. And there is a truth. People can have different perspectives or different opinions or different views of how an incident went down. But there really at the core is only one truth. Now, it has become harder in recent years, a lot having to do with many, many forces, political strife and polarization, et cetera. I think getting to the truth has become much harder. There's organizations, foreign governments, individuals who are trying to confuse people. They're pushing misinformation or disinformation. So it's become much harder to tell what is truth and what isn't. That's also been a consequence of the breakdown in media. So going from a small coterie of outlets that controlled the narrative and controlled the dissemination of the news to now anyone who has a phone, anyone who has a blog, anybody who has followers and influence can convey or speak about topics about which at the end of the day, they don't even necessarily know what they're talking about, but they have tremendous power and impact because millions or tens of millions of people are listening to what they do and what they say. Now, this question of apologies, I think, gets to, I'm going to start by talking about sort of general crisis communications best practices and then weave that into what I think is one of the vital things in this country at the moment, which is how the apology has been destroyed by cancel culture. So in terms of apology and versus doubling down, let me be very clear. If your organization has made a mistake, it is okay to acknowledge that mistake, to apologize for it, to articulate the things that you're going to do to address it, and then move on. So that's kind of crisis PR 101. And many times organizations that are willing to go headfirst at a crisis to recognize that what happened wasn't optimal, but then to explain why what went down, what you're doing as the leader or as the organization to address it, the public can be very forgiving. And you can actually use that time of crisis to build more customer loyalty, to build respect, to gain people who actually trust you because you're not denying. The other thing I would say is if something happened, don't deny it. Don't lie. Never lie. And there's this misperception about PR that we're people who do communications, that we're spin doctors, that we're spinning the truth, that we're introducing alternate facts, which was a phrase that one of President Trump's advisors, Kellyanne Conway, introduced. I would recommend to everyone, you hew closely to the facts and you speak the truth and you don't misrepresent. That's how we comport ourselves as professionals. And I think it's a best practice for any organization. Don't lie because the truth will come out and you will be outed. And then it looks worse because you've lied. Now, to slide into what I was saying about cancel culture, I think the apology and whether organizations should apologize, this is part of the reason I wrote a book called The Cancel Culture Curse, is because it is so vital as businesses, as organizations, but also on a personal level. We have to be able to make mistakes. And when we make a mistake, or if we offend someone, or if we do something that harms someone, we have to be able to offer an apology and then receive forgiveness and hopefully absolution and be able to move on. The problem with cancel culture, which is this new phenomenon, is once a cancel culture mob, I like to refer to them as cancel vultures because they like to swoop down on wounded prey and just pick you apart, and they feed on the pain and the death of other people and their reputations. So once you've got the cancel vultures bearing down on you, it has fundamentally changed the equation. Apologizing can become very much a losing strategy because it used to be, Steve, if you did something to offend me or to hurt me, I could tell you that I didn't like it. You would apologize to me, and then I could accept your apology and we could move on. The problem with living in a cancel culture world is the scenario changes. Steve, you do something that offends me. I demand an apology from you. You apologize to me. And then I and my fellow cancel vultures say, I don't accept your apology. And see, you proved that you did what I said you were going to do. You're a bad guy. And therefore, you don't deserve to be forgiven, and we want to cancel you, and we want to eliminate your ability to ever redeem yourself or move forward. And that's part of the danger of living in a world where cancel culture is an acceptable way of dealing with people. What constitutes cancel culture versus accountability? Let me also say there's this notion that we need cancel culture as a thing in order to hold people to account. And they point to examples like Harvey Weinstein, who is the most well-known example of the Me Too movement, where women came forward and they spoke out against sexual harassment or assault that had happened to them. And Harvey Weinstein is not an example of cancel culture. He is an example of a person who did something being held to account. And in this country and in society going back thousands of years, there have always been means by which the collective could deal with people who stepped outside of the laws or what was deemed acceptable within that community. Harvey Weinstein's in a prison cell, not because he was canceled, but because he was charged in a court and he was found guilty and he was punished. So I think conflating cancel culture with some of these people being held to account is dangerous, and it doesn't help elucidate or explain why cancel culture itself is its own phenomenon. Let me give you what I believe is the definition of cancel culture, and then I'm going to give you what I see based on research and helping people who have been cancel culture targets, what I view as the essential elements that comprise cancel culture. So the definition is the use of intimidation by a morally absolute coalition to isolate and disproportionately punish an alleged transgressor. Okay. So in terms of the six elements of cancel culture, you can remember them with this acronym CANDEM, C-A-N-D-E-M. C, the crime or the alleged transgression has to be something that's committed against a collective. So it's a group. So you've either done something that is offensive to women or people of color or someone of a certain gender identity or religious background, et cetera. The point is, it's not one-to-one communication. You haven't just, Steve, you and I haven't just had a disagreement. It becomes bigger than just you and I arguing over something. A collective gets involved. The A is that it arises and it accelerates rapidly, which can happen today because of interconnectedness of cell phones and the transfer of information, rapid fire. And that's why cancel culture is a unique phenomenon, because a story that used to be isolated and localized goes global in a matter of seconds. The N is that the nature of the offense is either fabricated or it's relatively minor. So we've taken words and an insult or a comment that wasn't well articulated, and then we've taken it to therefore somehow the nature of the offense is blown out of proportion, the extent to which a person needs to be punished because they said something or they did something. The D is that it prompts a disproportionate response. So it's not just that you upset me and therefore you can apologize and we're done and we can move forward. It's, I don't accept your apology. I think you're a bad guy. Therefore, I'm going to campaign against you. I'm going to try to shut down your podcast. I'm going to prevent you from getting book deals. I'm going to try to shout you down if you speak publicly. A disproportionate response. The E in cancel culture of the six elements is that everyone's afraid to defend the accused. And we know that that's the case because I've worked on many of these cases, and family members and friends don't want to get involved because they don't want the cancel vultures coming after them. And then the final element in the condemn framework is the M, the moral absolutism. The people doing the canceling, the people campaigning to destroy the person who's the target of their ire, they believe that they can and should do whatever it takes to hurt this individual, because they have the moral high ground and the person's going to get what they have coming to them. So I think those six elements, the condemn framework, are a useful way. And if you apply it to cases in the news today, it provides a very useful framework for determining whether or not an instance actually is cancel culture or it's not. And it's important to define it, because if you don't define it, then you can't defeat it.
When would you say cancel culture became a thing? Was there an event? Was there an inflection point where all of a sudden it became a thing? And then also maybe tied into that, do you think this represents a change in human behavior that we have cancel culture? And what is the impact of this global communication that we have today with the internet, with mobile phones? How do all those factors play into, we have cancel culture today, and you're making the argument that we didn't have cancel culture 50 years, 100 years, 1,000 years ago.
No, we didn't. We had accountability. We did have social ostracization. And you had, if you look back to the times of the Salem witch trials in the United States, that's a perfect example. Political witch hunts, when you've got groups of people who are turning on each other. That's been happening since time immemorial. You know, people who are religious could go back to the Bible and point to, you know, Cain and Abel, the two brothers having a conflict and one turning on the next. Other biblical stories, those examples abound. I think cancel culture itself is a relatively new phenomenon because of how the punishments are enacted. And the other thing that fundamentally changed was it's not just a conflict of one-to-one, it's become a gang up, a mob. Now that has existed also for a long time. Think of mob justice, think of lynchings, think of misinformation that spurred a group to jump into action. Now the difference is today, the internet has given voice to powerless people, and it's created a scenario where people can go from the safety of their own home. They can even do it anonymously. They don't have to put their actual name attached to their social media handle. People can become activists in taking each other out and becoming keyboard warriors, or, you know, in their minds, they're doing something to help the greater good. But I think what's changed fundamentally is because the internet catalogs things and it lasts forever, cancel culture is eliminating the ability of organizations and people to make a mistake, but then move forward. And I think it's a very dangerous phenomenon. And I think it's very negative for all of us to be held to this standard where we have to be perfect. Because guess what? None of us is. Every single person has done or said something that we should try to take back, or that we probably in retrospect shouldn't have done. And the problem with this world that we've created right now is, you know, where does it end? You can go back and you can find something that someone said 10 years ago, 15 years ago. You can find what someone said that wasn't even necessarily true. And then you can hang them based on that. And I think that's what's fundamentally changed. And there's a whole litany of things that have combined to make cancel culture a thing right now. It's the 24/7 news cycle. It's the interconnectedness of the internet. It is also just the feeling that people want to do something and the powerless feel like they have power. All these things, and in a time of rage and increased uncertainty and anxiety, it's a powder keg and it's a perfect storm. And that's why we see cancel culture happening now. But I also think there is a path forward. There is a way to hold people to account. We have due process in this country. We have a presumption of innocence until proven guilty. And I think the American framework that the founders had in mind, it's worked pretty well since the founding. Yes, we're an imperfect country. We can always do better. There's tons of areas where we have to improve. But I think we as a society need to move back to a time where you could make mistakes and you could learn from them. And I think for CEOs and lifelong learners, people who build companies, they know and they understand perhaps better than anyone. You know, in Silicon Valley, they champion this notion of fail hard, fail fast. Make a mistake, make it quickly, learn from it and pivot. So I think business owners and entrepreneurs fundamentally understand that there's a process that has to happen and you become better and you learn through the mistakes. But what we can't do is allow this cancel culture mentality whereby people are held to an impossible standard and they're never, ever allowed to make a mistake and to learn and to grow from it.
I'm not sure that human behavior has essentially changed, but the ability to amplify the worst instincts of human behavior are very different today, obviously, because of technology. The bottom line is, what do we do about it? You started to touch on this here just a moment ago in terms of, as human beings, we need to figure out a way to work through this. So in your role in crisis communication, you obviously try and help people that come to you as clients with that. But it seems like the genie's out of the bottle here. We're not putting the internet away. Communication is only getting more aggressive. We've got artificial intelligence, which of course in recent months here has become super popular with ChatGPT and other similar things. So what's the solution to all of this that doesn't rely on culture wars to continue to divide the country?
The problem is not the tools. The problem is how the tools are being used. And the answer is, you know, we as a country have to get back to this idea that people can have disagreements and they can have different visions, but there needs to be competition in the marketplace of ideas, and there should be free speech, and there should be debate. And we need to move away from this idea that it's a zero-sum game and that you need to have a lock on your version of the truth, that your view on an issue is the right, the absolutist view. We need to be willing and able. And I think one of the things that's been a strength of the United States from day one is this idea that no topic is off limits in terms of discussion, and let the best idea win. And I think it's something that works very well in the business world, and it needs to come over from the business world into overall society. Yeah, the genie is out of the bottle in terms of these tools, the internet, the idea that anything you do or say can be cataloged and it's there, advances in technology, including AI, you know, ChatGPT is a great example. I think there's going to be huge threats, by the way, down the road in terms of the industry that I'm in and the business of helping companies and individuals. I think the AI and deep fakes in particular are going to create huge headaches for CEOs and businesses moving forward, because now you're not only being forced to press the truth to correct misinformation that people read about, but now you're trying to unwind in their heads what they've seen. When they see a video or they see a photo that makes it look like you've done something, you first have to contest that it was even you, and you have to, it just becomes infinitely more complex. But I think at the bottom line, at its most basic element, is we have to get back to just agreeing that as a country, we're best served by having debates, by arguing based on the merits of arguments, taking away this ad hominem, attack the person mentality. And the sooner we get back to championing free speech, open dialogue, and discussion, the sooner we're going to get back to viewing our neighbors as fellow countrymen who have a vested interest in the success of the country, and we'll spend a lot less time picking each other apart. And I think that's something that we're really going to have to get to. I do believe it's possible. I do believe, yes, there are base instincts of people that are unchanged over hundreds or thousands of years on the negative side. But I also think that there's a lot of people out there who believe we've kind of reached nearly this rock bottom, and that in order for us to succeed as a country and what's in our best interests, we are going to have to find ways to work with people on the other side and stop viewing everything as a tribal conflict, left versus right, Republican, Democrat. These labels don't help us, and all they do is hurt.
Well, we could definitely talk for hours about this, Evan, but I think we're going to have to wrap here. I do want to go through two or three rapid fire questions here. So let's go back to before you were 20. Was there an experience in your younger days that had a huge impact on the person that you are today?
I think for me, it was involvement in team sports. I was a soccer player my whole young life. I had a passion for soccer. And I think the lessons that I learned from being involved in a team sport as opposed to an individual sport, having to learn how to work with people who had different skill levels in order to work as a unit, to find a way to win as a team, the idea that any single individual is not going to make the difference, that you could have one person who's a game changer or who's a key element, but in soccer, there's 11 people on the field. And if you got 10 people who suck and one who's amazing, you're still going to lose. So this idea that you have to build a team, you have to work together, and also success comes through hard work, and you have to be willing to practice and to get better every day so that when the game time comes, you're prepared and ready to perform at the highest level. And I think it's got some real lessons for business and life as well.
I know you have been a longtime member of EO. So as you talk about the importance of a team, I know whether we're talking EO or we're talking YPO or a number of the other similar type organizations out there, tell me about your experience in EO and working with a team of other professionals. How has that helped you and the team there at Red Banyan?
I'm the biggest advocate, believer, booster, fan, et cetera, of organizations like EO and YPO, because they create a safe space of learning and collaboration between people who oftentimes can feel lonely. When you start a company, when you're trying to build a company out of nothing, it's a very, very tough process. And there's a lot of pressure and there are huge swings up and down. The path is never a gilded one. And I think that organizations like EO and YPO are vital in terms of creating a way for people to learn from each other. I can tell you when I joined EO, I actually started in what they call their accelerator program. So these are early stage businesses that are well under $1 million in revenue, and they're trying to graduate you by pairing you up with a mentor or a coach to get you to $1 million and then beyond. For me, it was life-changing because when I started my company, I knew very well how to do PR, how to write, how to be a practitioner. I had no clue anything about business. When someone asked me about a P&L, I literally had no idea what they were talking about. I barely understood the difference between revenue and profit. So for someone like me, who was an expert in their field and knew how to do the work, yet had no background in terms of business or finance, my education and my growth in learning as a CEO and a founder, I owe it all really to EO.
And I know many of the folks listening to this are part of EO or YPO or some of the other organizations. So we all definitely would agree with everything that you just said there. So second question I want to ask here is about a book. So we love talking about books. I know you've written books. Your current one here is called The Cancel Culture Curse, From Rage to Redemption in a World Gone Mad. So pick up your copy of that one. But what's another book, one that you haven't written that you've read that has been very influential to you? And what's like a key idea from it that's really shaped you?
It's one that a lot of people haven't heard of. It's called The Big Leap by Gay Hendricks. And he's a therapist, actually. It's not some sort of a kumbaya, far-fetched self-help guru type of read. But what it is it's a book about how to identify the thoughts in our heads and the things that are holding us back from being the people who we have the potential to become, and how to identify those things and how to cast them off. And so I think for me, I reread the book, The Big Leap, literally every year because I need to be reminded of those concepts. And I think one of the other major concepts that comes from The Big Leap that I try to talk about with my team and help them understand is Gay Hendricks talks about the difference between existing in a zone of incompetence, a zone of competence, and a zone of genius, and differentiating between the types of work or things that we can do on a day-to-day basis, how we spend our time, which is, of course, our most valuable asset, and the concept of trying to find a way to spend your time, the bulk of your time, in your zone of genius was really eye-opening to me. And I try to encourage my team members and to walk the talk myself, to spend a lot more time in my zone of genius than my zone of competence, and to try stay the hell out of my zone of incompetence.
Well, and I'm glad you mentioned his book, because our Mark Moses has written a couple books here all around the idea of making big happen. And so much of making big happen is not just what you do, but it's how you think. And I think the first book, The Big Leap, as you were mentioning there, one of the key ideas there was really about the way that you think. And so much of success boils down to your level of thinking, the bigness of your thinking, the expansiveness of your thinking. And if you get stuck thinking small, thinking incrementally, then yeah, maybe you're going to grow 10 or 15% per year, but you're not going to get that explosive exponential growth unless you have a mind that can think in those terms, because it's only then that you're going to be able to see the opportunity and know that getting just a little bit better. Yes, of course, we want to get a little bit better at everything, but to take that big leap, as the title of his book, we typically have to come up with a brand new way of thinking and doing things. that put us on a new S curve of explosive growth. So I appreciate you mentioning that. So
of course. And let me just say, you know, I've known and worked with Mark for many years, and I've learned a lot from Mark Moses. I've read both of his books, and I think he is a great example of someone who, anyone who's met Mark and knows that his message of make big happen, it's about opening up your eyes to what could be and the possibility. And I think he does a great job as an ambassador for thinking big and making big happen. And I just want to say, like, I think Mark's outstanding, and actually one of his coaches who used to be coached by Mark now coaches me. And that idea that you have to think big in order to get big has been wildly helpful for me and the growth of my company too.
Well, Evan, if folks want to connect with you and learn more about what you're doing there at Red Banyan, what's the best way for folks to stay in touch?
I'm just now active on Twitter. I assiduously avoided it for a long time, but I'm getting active there because I feel like I have to, as relates to the book and talking about cancel culture. So you can find me on Twitter at Evan Nierman. You can find me on LinkedIn. I accept connections from people even that I don't know. You can find me at Red Banyan, obviously, or you can pick up a copy of my book, Amazon.com, Audible, or wherever books are sold. It's called The Cancel Culture Curse. And I look forward to continuing the conversation with whomever reaches out. I love talking to CEOs. I love talking to like-minded lifelong learners. So hit me up and we'll connect.
Sounds great. All right. Well, appreciate you being on the show, Evan.
Thank you so much for having me. This was great.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. Now, I have a question for you. How are you going to implement and benefit from the ideas that you hear on our show? Well, we would love to have a conversation with you about that. So please visit us at ceocoachinginternational.com. We can then set up a call and we can talk about how we can help you make big happen in your business. Thanks, and we look forward to sharing our next episode with you.